1937 and the years 1939 when I was not a candidate for re-election.
Well, bringing up the subject of candidacy for re-election, I think it would be important for our listeners to know that the chief clerk is not necessarily a continuous employee but must be elected. How do you get elected for this office each term?
Well, each session of the odd-numbered years, we make a canvass of the members of the assembly, writing personal letters to each of them and ask each member for his vote. And if we are successful in getting 41 votes, that is sufficient number to elect the chief clerk.
Well, fine, Arthur, and I know that from talking with the members up here over the past 4 years, there's never been a thought, so far as I've ever heard, even whispered, that you could possibly be unseated. I think you're one of the political figures in California in a nonpartisan basis and a public servant who has a following of devotion among the members of our House equal to none. Now, Arthur, I'd like to refer again to your statement where you said we are elected. What other members of the legislative clerk's office are elected?
I used that word we, Mr. Beaver, editorially, and as Lindbergh used it. The chief clerk, the minute clerk, the sergeant at arms, and the chaplain. Those are the four officers of the assembly, outside of the speaker and the speaker pro tempore, who are elected by the members.
Well, that's fine. And that's provided how? In the rules of the legislature itself?
That is provided by the rules.
And not by the Constitution or a statutory requirement?
Well, there are statutory requirements. That is, the government code has certain provisions setting forth who the officers of the assembly are and how they shall be elected and what vote is required for their election.
Fine. Well, now, Arthur, we know every time that we come here to meet at the opening session, everyone observes the fact that you are the person who opens the legislature. It isn't the speaker, and it isn't the speaker pro tem or any member of the House, but it's always you. Why is this?
Well, that's rather an interesting thing. We come to the Senate. The Senate has 40 members, 20 of which are elected every 2 years. The presiding officer of the Senate is the lieutenant governor. And then, of course, the Senate has a president pro tempore. Now, either of those members or officers of the Senate can call the Senate to order. The members of the Assembly are elected in the even-numbered year and take office in the odd-numbered year. So you have a new House of 80 members. So in order that there could be no conflict and someone would be authorized and directed to call the session to order, the chief clerk of the last session was authorized to do that job. In his absence or disability, the senior member elect of the assembly would perform that duty, or one of the deputy attorney generals.
Fine. Well, now, Arthur, let me ask you this kind of tricky question. You've observed over, let's see, 1923, is that the figure when you first came here?
That is correct, Mr.
Let's
Beaver.
Let's see, 33, 43, 53, 35 years, so all told. How many sessions have you opened, Arthur?
Well, I've opened each one of the regular sessions, and there have been quite a number of extraordinary sessions. I haven't the number right at my fingertips. And, of course, the extraordinary session being a new session, the chief clerk calls that session to order the same as he does the regular session.
Let's go into this question. Now, once you have called the session to order, what is the next order of business to relieve you of the responsibility of opening the session?
You mean the election of the permanent officers?
Yes.
After the routine business, such as reading the certificates of election and having the opening prayer, the next real order of business is the election of speaker. And as soon as the speaker is elected, he takes the rostrum, and then the chief clerk is relieved of his duties of presiding.
Now, once you're relieved of the presiding duties, Arthur, what are your responsibilities?
Then you return to the desk and see that the usual routine is carried forth, see that the procedure goes forth as smoothly as possible.
Well, now, does this include parliamentarian advice to the speaker?
If the speaker would like you to do it, yes.
Well, I've noticed over the years, Arthur, that you've always been a principal advisor to the Speaker on parliamentary questions. I didn't really know, however, whether that was at the Speaker's request or there was some provision that you were required to do that.
No, it's usually at the Speaker's request. The reason is the Speaker has 79 members on the floor that he must watch. And if some person raises a parliamentary inquiry or raises a point of order, it is helpful to any person who is presiding to have someone below the desk give him the information from the book, telling him what rule it is so he can turn to it quickly, or citing him the page in Mason's Manual. That's very helpful to anyone who is presiding.
You know, Arthur, one of the things that you and I were talking about here before we went on the air a few minutes ago was the subject of women in the legislature. Have there ever been any women senators in California?
Never to my knowledge, Mr. Beaver. I think the closest that the Senate ever came to that was in electing the Secretary of the Senate. There was a woman Secretary of the Senate some years ago.
Was that before Joe Beek's time?
I think that was an interruption in Joe Beek's time. I think Joe Beek took 2 years off.
Oh, I see.
And then returned to be reelected as Secretary of the Senate.
Now, we over here in the Assembly side, Arthur, as you know, are graced today by two women members. Has this been customary? I mean, have there always been women members over the great many years?
Yes. I think we can go back probably to 1919. I think the first woman member that I can recall was Mrs. Elizabeth Hughes from Oroville, Butte County. And at one time, Mr. Beaver, there were five women members of the Assembly.
Well, now, this is certainly long before my time, Arthur. How much influence did they have? Did they hang together pretty well as women on various issues?
Well, I think that on the whole, they represented their constituents just about in the same way that the men represent their districts.
Well, you know, frequently with the two ladies that we have as members now, both Miss Donahue and Pauline Davis, frequently refer to themselves as assemblymen, and I think that's the correct term, isn't it, and not assemblywoman?
That was the term which was used in the code, but I think we've kind of gotten away a little bit from that and become a little bit more realistic, and we really call them assemblywomen now.
I understand. I know that the listeners might be curious to, might find this interesting. Ladies and gentlemen, Arthur and I both realize that it gets pretty hot here in the springtime, late spring, when we're going in a regular session, and it's always been the practice, as long as I've been here, that the members will request permission of the women members of the House before they take off their coats in the springtime, and I think that's one of the little eccentricities that we enjoy out of deference to their sex. Other than that, though, would you say that there is any deference to the sex in matters of legislation and the movement of bills?
No, I don't think so, Mr. Beaver. I think some years ago there was one other little courtesy which was usually extended to the ladies, and that was one of the members, lady members, would arise and move that Rule 71 be suspended. The old Rule 71 was the rule prohibiting smoking.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Well, now do we. I've never noted in the years that I've been here that we've ever had any argument about smoking on the floor. What was usually the background of this before?
Well, see, that was an old rule, Rule 71, but as the years advanced and as more women smoked, the rule just finally went into the air, as it were. I don't think it's in the books anymore.
I see. Well, that's consistent with what both of our women members have constantly told me, that they'd like to be treated just the same as the men up here in all matters of legislation, and that's quite a tribute to them. Let me ask you, Arthur, are there any other states like California in the United States that have areas of representation as large as we do? I'm thinking particularly of the 2nd and the 6th Assembly districts, which cover such vast areas.
Mr. Beaver, that's a very interesting question. I made some little research on that question, and while a number of the states have more counties than California, and a great many of the states have more districts than California, I was unable to find any state in the Union that had an area as large as either the 2nd or the 6th Assembly districts. Incidentally, those two districts, starting from the 2nd district from the Oregon line and ending with the 6th district down at the Kern County line, taking the entire backbone of the Sierras.
That's amazing. And those two districts are represented by two individual assemblymen, and they are, for the most part, I'm sure, larger than many states.
I think that is correct. And incidentally, it might be of interest to know that one of the representatives is a Democrat and the other is a Republican.
Well, at least half the backbone of the state is split evenly. Well, now, Arthur, let's talk a little bit about interim committees and standing committees. Would you care to explain the difference between the two?
The standing committees are the committees which are set up during the session. When a bill is introduced in the Assembly, it is immediately, in 90% of the cases, in fact, even a higher percentage, sent to a committee so that the committee can consider the subject matter of the bill. And if the bill has merit, it is then returned to the floor of the Assembly so that the entire membership may consider the measure. After the sine die adjournment of the Assembly, interim committees are set up to study a great many subjects so that they can submit their recommendations to the next session of the legislature, particularly the Assembly. And the Assembly would then have the advantage of the study which has been made by these committee and the members during the interim.
Well, now, that brings up the subject of appointment of membership to committees and the difference that there may exist between the two houses. For example, most people realize that the committee assignments in the Assembly are made by the Speaker, but this isn't absolutely true, is it?
No, Mr. Beaver, there is one exception in the Assembly. The Committee on Rules is elected by the membership. That is, three members are elected by the Republicans and three members are elected by the Democrats, and then the Speaker appoints the chairman, so that makes you a seven-member committee. In the Senate, the committees are selected by the Committee on Rules, probably the reason being that the lieutenant governor is not a senator.
I see. So that really gives 41 members over in that House, although the lieutenant governor does not even have a tie vote, does he?
Yes, he has a tie vote, but not in committees.
Not in committee is what I meant. But now, supposing a bill were on the floor in the Senate and the vote were 20-20, could he cast the 41st vote?
Yes.
Now, that's, however, we don't have an 81st vote in our House, do we?
No, you do not.
Well, that's very interesting, Arthur. Now, let me ask you this. Some time ago, there was talk that there should be a restriction on the number of members that could be appointed to committees. I think the thought behind this was to reduce the membership so that fewer members would consider, perhaps more efficiently, the subject matter that comes before committees. In the course of your long experience here, Arthur, have you seen the membership on committees grow extensively, or has it simply been a case of members being appointed to perhaps more committees than there used to be?
There has been a great change, both in your committees and in the committee setup, which, of course, is very natural because the state itself has undergone great changes. As, for instance, we used to have a very important committee here called Irrigation. Then there was another one, Drainage, Swamp, and Overflowed Lands, something that you don't even hear of anymore. Those committees, by virtue of the great changes which have taken place in the state, went out of existence, and other committees like Conservation Planning and Public Works took their place. So it is very difficult to answer that question directly.
Well, what you've had then is the natural attrition of one kind of committee and having it reconstitute itself into a committee of the same general subject matter, but even maybe broader in scope.
That is correct, with a far fewer number of committees today than there were many years ago. You have about one half of the committees now that you did years ago.
Well, in addition to that, too, Arthur, isn't it possible for the legislature itself to alter the nature and size of its committees, to create new committees, to abandon committees, and in general set up its own committee system with the exception of the appointment procedure?
It has done that over the years in order to keep progress with the times.
And this is done by resolution, I presume?
With resolution and the amendment to the rules. It's a very flexible condition and should be that way.
Now, I was struck 4 years ago, almost unbelievably, when I was sitting on the floor as a brand new freshman member, and I heard a member get up and ask to suspend the Constitution. Now, this to me was a very startling request, and furthermore, the request was agreed to. I mean, the membership simply said yes, the Constitution may be suspended, and the Speaker, on vote of the House, did just that. Well, I think that can be easily misunderstood and strike fear into the average California citizen if they thought we could just suspend the Constitution and do things within the legislative body itself without any reference to the people. And I think you, as the expert on this matter, should explain just what that really means.
Well, I think that's You've given a very good dissertation on that. The Constitution can't be suspended unless the Constitution gives the legislature the right to suspend it. The Constitution is only suspended on the question of the three readings of bills. The Constitution provides that each bill must be read on three several days unless in case of urgency. That provision of the Constitution is suspended. That is the only provision of the Constitution which is suspended by the legislature.
Well, I understand that now, of course, Arthur, and I learned about it quick. But I think anyone who might be sitting in the audience or in the balcony here watching the legislature at work would certainly just about fall out of the balcony, as I almost fell out of my chair when I heard that request made, because it certainly was one of my most vivid impressions of my freshman year. Well, now, Arthur, as you know, we're in the middle of the budget session. We met up here for 2 days, some 3 weeks ago, the 3rd and 4th of February. The budget bill was introduced and referred to the budget committee, and our listeners know the budget committee was broken up into subcommittees, and now we're coming down to the wire of reconvening the entire legislature again for consideration of the budget. I think, from the standpoint of the chief clerk, I'd like to know your opinion as to, really not your opinion, but I'd like to know a little of your experience and background in handling the budgets not only this year, but in the years past. There's a change this time, which we enacted last year, which makes the handling of the budget slightly different. Would you like to comment about that?
Yes, I think this is the first time that the budget, that you've ever had a bifurcated budget session. In 1948, you started off with the sessions, the budget sessions, in the even-numbered years. And the first sessions, 1948 and immediately subsequent to that date, there were a number of subjects which could be considered. Then an amendment to the Constitution was adopted, restricting the consideration in the even-numbered or budget year to the budget bill, revenue acts necessary, therefore, the expenses of the legislature, and charter amendments to cities and cities and counties. Then this last amendment, while it retained those restrictive provisions, also contained the provision for the bifurcated budget session in order that the Ways and Means Committee could have an opportunity of studying the budget during the interim and reporting to the legislature when the House reconvened.
I think this should prove to be a little more efficient handling, don't you, Arthur?
It would appear so.
Well, we've just about run out of time. I think that as kind of a wind-up, and again, as I introduced you to our listening audience as a wise and experienced hand up here over these many, many years, have you witnessed any change in the efficiency of government and the way the legislature is responsive to the people? Would you kind of like to make a closing comment about that?
Well, I think that today the members of the legislature are closer to the people than they have ever been in the history of this state. And I think that is true for a great number of reasons. Many years ago, as men coming up here from the south or distant portions of the state, they were not as close to the people as they are today when you can fly down, for instance, to your home in a matter of hours, where years ago it would take you a matter of a day almost to get home. I think that brings in a condition of closeness which hadn't existed previously.
Well, thank you very much, Arthur Onimus. It's certainly been a pleasure for me to have you here in the office in the state capitol in Sacramento talk to the listening audience of KCAL. After all, you've been here longer than anybody, at least on our side of the house. You've seen this thing change for not just a few terms, but for literally decades. And I would certainly close with a tribute to you. I don't know what we're going to do if you ever leave here, Arthur.
Thank you so much, Mr. Beaver.
Good afternoon.